Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is side one of For the Record program number 556, titled Update on September 11th and Related Matters. This is being recorded on June 4th of the year 2006. Before I get into the main body of the broadcast, let me stress once again that listeners should avail themselves of the vast amount of material that is available online. Those of you who only listen to the broadcasts themselves, whether you listen live on the radio or you listen on the internet, you're missing an awful lot of the For the Record experience. There is a vast amount of printed information, including long article-length descriptions of each For the Record broadcast. There are books available, old anti-fascist books, which will flesh out people's understanding of the history of fascism. There are links to two websites maintained by sister station WFMU-FM, which is archiving, WFMU that is archiving the entire For the Record series on real audio. WFMU is also podcasting the For the Record programs. On the Spitfire website, www.spitfirelist.com, there's a link to a website in the Midwest maintained by listeners that contain the declassified government documents proving the Bush family's complicity with Nazi industry before, during, and most importantly, in my estimation, after World War II, when the Bush family and people around them were complicit in some of the post-war flight capital program. There are also, there's a search function, as I mentioned, on the website. A diligent listener is turning the For the Record descriptions into a blog sphere. Some of you may find that easier to read than the For the Record descriptions themselves. All in all, there's a vast amount of material available, and it is growing all the time. So please, please, please do take advantage of the tremendous amount of printed material available on the Spitfire and linked websites. With regard to September 11th and related matters, a vitally important and extremely complex subject, one that I've been investigating for many years now, the use of those printed materials, I think, is really essential for a decent understanding. Now, we are going to take a look at some recent developments, which in turn are reflective of developments in the past. One of the things that I believe has led to the cover-up of September 11th, one of the contributing factors is the fact that September 11th was the outgrowth of decades of policy, really the better part of a half century of policy going all the way back to the closing days of World War II, when along with other fascist groups, the Muslim Brotherhood was requisitioned by U.S. intelligence to serve in an anti-communist capacity. The Muslim Brotherhood was by no means unique in that regard. The Muslim Brotherhood has morphed over the years. It has had offshoots, including Al-Qaeda, Hamas, and Palestinian Islamic Jihad, about which we'll have more to say later. One of the factors that looms large in the analytical landscape, so to speak, of September 11th is something that we spoke about in For the Record programs 522 and 524, and that is something called the Safari Club. The Safari Club was a back-channel or off-the-shelf intelligence network financed largely by Saudi Arabia's growing oil wealth and utilized by the United States and others basically to perform functions that would have been a little too dicey to perform under official circumstances. One of the complicated issues vis-a-vis investigating September 11th, something that I think is one of the complicating factors with regard to Daniel Hopsicker's heroic work in South Florida, and that is how much of what is going on is actually an official government operation and how much is an off-the-books, off-the-shelf operation, which cannot be officially traced through government channels. And how much of it, how much of these activities is actually being run by people who are operatives for one government or another, but operating in a private capacity, either for a powerful capital interest or simply as part of their own criminal conspiratorial milieu. The Safari Club functioned in conjunction with U.S. intelligence. It represents in a very real way sort of an outsourcing of U.S. intelligence, and yet at the same time, it was a privatization and globalization of key U.S. intelligence functions. The Safari Club provided the bulk of the support for the Afghan Mujahideen support effort against the Soviets in the 1980s. That, of course, that war led to the christening, probably should use a different word, led to the launching of Osama bin Laden as a warrior. And it also led to the creation of Al-Qaeda. The MAK, the Afghan Mujahideen, was one of the offshoots of the Muslim Brotherhood. And it was the Safari Club that was the key element in supporting the Afghan Mujahideen effort. And there are a whole lot of very, very dirty things indeed, stretching back decades vis-a-vis that whole operation. The drug smuggling that later has helped to finance Al-Qaeda has also was used to help finance the Afghan Mujahideen support effort, much of that done under the auspices of the Safari Club, and perhaps most importantly, the AQ Khan nuclear smuggling network, which has basically given nuclear technology to a number of different nations. The AQ Khan nuclear smuggling network, it was basically operating under the umbrella, the protective umbrella of the Safari Club. The Safari Club is covered at great length in a remarkable and very important book called Prelude to Terror by Joe Trento. Unfortunately, that book has not got a lot of play, but in For the Record programs 522, and 524, there is good discussion of the Safari Club and Joe Trento's landmark work. Ultimately, I suspect that the AQ Khan Network's nuclear technology is going to prove to be the ultimate example of blowback against the United States. It would not surprise me if the mushroom cloud that Condi Rice was invoking with regard to Saddam Hussein invalidly ultimately did come to take place. It would not surprise me ultimately if the next terrorist incident, probably involving weapons of mass destruction, involved the importation of the actual destructive instrument through some of these controlled and protected drug smuggling networks, such as Daniel Hopsicker has investigated in South Florida. Certainly, the 911 hijackers infiltrated through just such a protected drug network. And it does not appear to me that there has been any significant disruption of those networks. So we'll see whether, as is the case in the book Serpent's Walk, the Nazi tract Serpent's Walk that I've spoken about, the next horror show is imported through some of these controlled drug smuggling networks, whether it's an AQ Khan generated nuclear device or a dirty bomb or CBW, who knows. But we will find out, I suspect, in dramatic and tragic fashion. Now, with regard to the AQ Khan network, bear in mind again, as we will review in a few minutes, that the AQ Khan network, which gave Pakistan and ultimately other Islamic nations the bomb, was a direct offshoot of the Safari Club's machinations. Basically, it was known that by aiding the Afghan Mujahideen and supporting the ISI's efforts in that regard, the ISI is the Pakistani Intelligence Service, this would ultimately lead to Pakistan getting the bomb. The United States was deeply complicit in the genesis of the AQ Khan network. And I suspect, this is conjecture, but I suspect it was that complicity that has led to some foot dragging with regard to the Swiss prosecution of people involved in the AQ Khan smuggling network. In some of our discussions with John Loftus, we're going to review the investigation into Bank al-Taqwa, John Loftus let us know that, in fact, with regard to the Swiss attempts at prosecuting Youssef Nada, a former Nazi intelligence agent, a member of the Muslim Brotherhood, and the head of the Bank al-Taqwa, which funded not only al-Qaeda but also Hamas and Palestinian Islamic Jihad, the U.S. government withheld documents that were requested by the Swiss prosecutors. That, plus foot-dragging, predictably, by elements of Bank al-Taqwa itself and the Saudis, basically led to a suspension of the Swiss investigation. And again, apparently the U.S. is dragging its feet with regard to cooperating with the Swiss on the AQ Khan network, at least thus far, and I suspect that that foot dragging on the part of the United States may very well be due to the fact that back in history, back 20 years or more, it can be determined that the United States itself bears a portion of responsibility and a significant portion of responsibility for the AQCon situation. The following article appeared in the Washington Post of Friday, May 26th of 2006. It's an article by Joby Warrick, W-A-R-R-I-C-K, titled U.S. Silence Impeding Swiss in Nuclear Case, subtitled Expert Says Calls Have Been Ignored. It reads in part as follows. 2 years after the United States helped disrupt a notorious nuclear smuggling ring, the Bush administration has hobbled a Swiss effort to prosecute three of the alleged leaders by failing to share critical information, an American nuclear expert and Swiss law enforcement officials said yesterday. Switzerland's federal prosecutor made at least four separate appeals for U.S. help over the past year, asking for access to documents and other evidence linked to the nuclear black market run by the Pakistani scientist Abdul Qadir Khan. In that time, the Swiss have received no assistance or even a reply, a spokesman for the prosecutor said. Quote, Swiss authorities are asking for additional assistance from U.S. authorities, but we haven't gotten an answer so far, unquote, Mark Weidmer, press secretary for the Swiss Attorney General's office, said in response to a reporter's inquiry. Quote, we are confident the American authorities will provide the information we need, unquote. The appeals were directed to the Justice Department, which has a bilateral agreement with Switzerland on sharing information in international criminal cases, and to the State Department's Undersecretary for Arms Control and International Security, according to officials knowledgeable about the requests. Calls to both agencies yesterday were not returned. The problem was brought to light yesterday by a U.S. weapons expert who was advising Swiss prosecutors on the technical aspects of the Khan case. In testimony before a subcommittee of the House International Relations Committee, David Albright said the U.S. government had, quote, ignored multiple requests for cooperation, unquote, in prosecuting members of the AQCon network. Quote, the prosecutors have not received a reply or even a confirmation that the U.S. government received the requests, unquote, Albright, a nuclear expert and president of the Institute for Science and International Security, told the panel. He said the lack of assistance, quote, needlessly complicates, unquote, an investigation of great importance to both countries. Swiss officials are seeking to bring charges against three businessmen who allegedly played pivotal roles in Khan's smuggling scheme. Swiss authorities have arrested Friedrich Tinner, a Swiss mechanical engineer, and his two sons, Urs and Marco, who are suspected of supplying the network with technology and equipment used in enriching uranium. Urs Tinner is also suspected of helping Khan set up a secret Malaysian factory that made thousands of components for gas centrifuges, machines used in uranium enrichment. Formal charges have not yet been brought against them. Some of the components were en route to Libya by ship in December 2003 when they were intercepted by German and Italian officials in a raid that brought the smuggling ring to light. The United States, which provided key intelligence that led to the intercept, heralded the breakup of the Khan network as a major blow against nuclear proliferation. In July 2004, President Bush viewed some of the components supplied by the Tinners during a visit to the Energy Department's Oak Ridge National Laboratory in eastern Tennessee. Bush called the Khan network, quote, one of the most dangerous sources of proliferation in the world, unquote, and attributed the successful breakup to the efforts of allies working together, unquote. Albright, in his testimony to the Subcommittee on International Terrorism and Nonproliferation, said, quote, I find this lack of cooperation frankly embarrassing to the United States and to those of us who believe that the United States should take the lead in bringing members of the Khan network to justice for arming our enemies with nuclear weapons, unquote. Well, a strong second there for Mr. Albright's sentiments from Dave Emery. One of the things, however, again, that needs to be borne in mind vis-a-vis September 11th and the many things related to it, First of all, one should not lose sight of the fact that this is a very complex event. It also is an event rooted many years back in history. And with regard to the AQ Khan network, AQ Khan is the father of the Pakistani bomb. His network can be documented to have given nuclear technology to many Muslim nations and quite possibly to North Korea as well. One of the things to bear in mind is that elements of U.S. intelligence, particularly those allied with the Safari Club, were complicit with the development of the Pakistani bomb and the AQ Khan network. Now, whether or not that complicity on the part of elements of U.S. intelligence, basically those allied with the Safari Club, whether that's the reason for the foot-dragging by the Bush Justice Department is a matter of speculation. However, what we're going to do now is to review some of the information that we looked at in For the Record program number 524. In turn, we're going to be accessing information from the aforementioned Prelude to Terror by Joseph Trento. That book was published in hardcover by Carolyn Graff in 2005. And again, one of the major focal points of that book was an off-the-shelf, privatized, outsourced, globalized intelligence element called the Safari Club. It represented a Saudi-financed outsourcing and globalization of key U.S. intelligence functions. It was the major element, again, in the Afghan Mujahideen support effort and a great many other things. And as we are about to review, as Joe Trento sets forth, as we saw in For the Record 524, and as we're going to in part review now, the Safari Club was deeply complicit with the development of the AQ Khan network, and officials in the United States willingly turned a blind eye to the AQ Khan network because it was seen as, at the very worst, a necessary evil that was acceptable in light of obtaining Pakistani cooperation against the Soviets in Afghanistan. Now, turning to some segments of Prelude to Terror by Joe Trento, we read, "The same leadership that promulgated the Safari Club, the Saudi royals, also strongly funded and supported the Islamic Development Bank. Begun in 1973, the IDB now has 55 member states, with Saudi Arabia dominating with 27.3% of the bank's funding. As a comparison, Egypt contributes 9.48% and Pakistan just 3.41% of the bank's total capital. It was through the bank's scientific and economic development efforts that huge amounts were funneled into Pakistan, which ended up in the hands of AQ Khan and his now infamous nuclear bomb-building syndicate. The effort that began prior to the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan and that President Carter's National Security Advisor warned was a serious effort to build the first Islamic bomb was deliberately ignored by Carter in order to secure Saudi and Pakistani cooperation for the anti-Soviet effort in Afghanistan. Like almost everything about the anti-Soviet effort, the Reagan administration expanded on it and the CIA directly assisted the Pakistani nuclear effort by allowing Pakistani nationals to procure hardware for the program in violation of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty." Skipping down. "What many people do not know is that the Safari Club had made a deal with Pakistan at the expense of the Afghan people. The Safari Club was run by the Saudis. It was a club to serve their purposes through the CIA. Theodore Shackley and Edwin Wilson were not members, only nations could belong. Shackley and Wilson were men who served the club in exchange for power, influence, and money," parenthetically interrupting Theodore Shackley and Edwin Wilson, two key players in U.S. intelligence, both over-the-counter and off-the-shelf, for decades. We looked at them in a big way in connection with not only the arming of Libya, but also, in particular, the Shackley-Wilson networks, along with Thomas Klein's, figured in a big way in the Iran-Contra support effort, and there's a great deal of material online and available from Spitfire about that. Continuing, "Pakistani intelligence would handle all the money going to facilitate the proxy war against the Soviets. That meant that hundreds of millions of dollars from the United States and Saudi Arabia were being run through Pakistan with no accountability. Unfortunately, said Robert Crowley, the Pakistanis knew exactly where their cut of the money was to go, unquote. Where the money went was into an Islamic nuclear weapons program supported by Saudi Arabia and accepted by the United States. During the early 1990s, British Customs began looking closely at the United States-Pakistan nuclear network. One of British intelligence's top agents was an Arabic-speaking Muslim who traveled the world tracking down AQ Khan's network. The British soon learned that the United States had no interest in shutting down the network, which had been operating for years. The Muslim customs agent, whose identity must be protected for his own safety, was actually confronted by Khan in Dubai, where the agent had traced a number of Khan's front companies. The agent testified in a trial involving associates of Khan's that the father of the Pakistani bomb confronted the Muslim customs agent and called him a, quote, traitor to Muslim people, unquote, for uncovering the nuclear network that was supplying weapons equipment to Libya, Iran, Malaysia, and North Korea. A top French intelligence official who asked that his name be withheld from publication described the U.S.-Pakistani cover-up of the Khan network as having, quote, an important precedent. Just as the U.S. allowed Israel to develop nuclear weapons, under pressure from the Saudis, the U.S. allowed Pakistan to be Saudi Arabia's proxy as the first Islamic nuclear state. The Saudis put up the cash and have clean hands as Pakistan builds the bomb for its supposed defense against India over Kashmir, but my country and the British received no cooperation starting in the 1980s when we discovered traces of Khan's network. The U.S. did not want to discuss it. Continuing. A senior source in the British government who asks not to be named confirms that Khan ran the network and that parts for the nuclear weapons program came from the United States. Khan's daughter, attending school in England, was being tutored, and at the ends of faxes dealing with logistics for her education, Khan would sometimes write in his own hand items he needed for the nuclear program. Pakistan's quest for nuclear weapons had begun some 15 years earlier. Shortly after taking office in 1972, Pakistani Prime Minister Zulfikar Ali Bhutto expressed his determination to develop a nuclear capability. His purpose was twofold: to offset the inherent threat posed by Pakistan's much larger neighbor and avowed enemy India, and to make his country a leader of the Islamic world. After India detonated its first atomic weapon on the Pakistani border in 1974, Bhutto pushed his nuclear program into high gear. To lead the effort, he tapped Abdul Qadir Khan, an accomplished metallurgist and businessman with a strong desire for wealth. To finance his ambitious program, Bhutto turned to his country's oil-rich ally Saudi Arabia and to Libya. China also pledged assistance. By 1976, when George Bush served as CIA director, U.S. intelligence estimates reported in a secret CIA report on Pakistan that Pakistan was engaged in a, quote, crash program to develop nuclear weapons. Bhutto wrote in his memoirs that his goal as prime minister had been to put the Islamic civilization on an even footing with the Christian, Jewish, and Hindu civilizations by creating a full nuclear capability, unquote, for the Islamic world. The man who overthrew Bhutto, General Muhammad Zia al-Huq, carried on that effort. In April of 1979, when President Zia refused to halt work on the Islamic bomb, unquote, President Jimmy Carter cut off American economic and military aid to Pakistan. Just 8 months later, however, following the Soviet Union's invasion of Afghanistan, Carter struck the ultimate Faustian bargain in order to win Zia's approval for using Pakistan as a base of operations for the Mujahideen. Zia's fortunes further improved following the 1980 election of Ronald Reagan and George H.W. Bush. With the covert U.S. war in Afghanistan intensifying, the Pakistani dictator gained significant advantage and used it. In addition to winning large economic and military aid packages for his country, he extracted a promise from the Reagan-Bush administration that there would be no U.S. interference in Pakistan's internal affairs. That meant no complaints about Zia's dictatorial rule and no obstruction of his efforts to build an Islamic bomb. To keep up appearances, Zia publicly maintained that he was not developing nuclear weapons. However, in 1983, a secret State Department briefing memo revealed that there was unambiguous evidence, unquote, that Pakistan was actively pursuing a nuclear weapons development program, unquote, and that China was providing technological assistance. At the time, U.S. law prohibited providing assistance to any country that was importing certain nuclear weapons technology. The Reagan-Bush administration simply ignored the legislation, arguing that cutting off aid to Pakistan would harm U.S. national interests. And again, this complicity, and I encourage listeners to listen to and or read the description for the Record 524. This goes on to document, again, deep U.S. complicity with the AQ-Khan network, which was seen as something of a quid pro quo in exchange for Pakistani aid for the Afghan Mujahideen against the Soviets. And indeed, the legacy of the Safari Club and the complicity on the part of elements of U.S. national security with the development of the AQ-Khan network can be seen in the fact that the two countries that are arguably our most important, quote, allies, unquote, in the war on terror, Saudi Arabia and Pakistan, are the two sovereign nations that can be verified to have actively assisted the September 11th attacks. There also were elements of German intelligence that appeared to have assisted those attacks as well, just as other elements of German intelligence were working against the Islamists, those actively subverted, apparently, as we can see in the investigation of the Sylvan Becker murder case, by the other elements. It's really similar to our own intelligence system, where some elements were working against the Islamists, others working for them. Unfortunately, with regard to the German intelligence, as was the case with the U.S. intelligence, the pro-Islamist elements prevailed. So again, when we see a disturbing development like the one that came to light this past week in the Washington Post, when we see failure on the part of the U.S., at least so far, to provide cooperation to the Swiss in their prosecution of people involved with the AQ-Khan network, bear in mind that at least one of the considerations there may be that a true investigation of the AQ-Khan network could leave the United States with a lot of egg on its face, because in the 1980s, and really going back to the late 70s, we were complicit in the development of that network, which was again a quid pro quo for Pakistani and Saudi assistance for the Afghan Mujahideen. Once again, going to Joe Trento's Prelude to Terror, according to Sognalian, that's Sarkis Sognalian, a Lebanese-born weapons dealer, according to Sognalian, the funds were first laundered through various BCCI accounts before being dispersed to ISI and into an elaborate network run by AQ Khan. Quote, Khan's network was controlled by the Saudis, not Khan, and Pakistan, Sognalian said. The Saudis were in on every major deal, including Iran, Libya, North Korea, and Malaysia. And those same Saudis are buying up large amounts of the United States. Corporate America, academic America, and indeed, nice chunks of members of listening audiences' very own A blank blanks, just to see what happens the next time you fill up your gas tank. This concludes side one of For the Record program number 556, update on September 11th and related matters. This is being recorded on June 4th of 2006. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.